This here, my good friends, we spent our spring vacation in England, Israel, and Rome, in that order. It was only partly a vacation, for in England, it turned that I was on a busman's holiday. I made speeches. I addressed the opening campaign dinners in behalf of the Joint Palestine Appeal, as they still call it. I spoke in London, in Manchester, and in Leeds. The meetings were very successful. More money, I was told, was raised than in any previous year. And my reception was very warm. And this intrigued me, for I had been led to believe that the reception would not be too cordial, since the prevailing notion over there had been that I was the arch opponent and severest critic of Dr. Weizmann. And England is, of course, Weizmann territory. But I was most agreeably surprised, pleased. My reception was not only cordial, but in many ways quite enthusiastic. And I left England with very pleasant memories. Memories like those which I carried away from England 20 years ago during the war, when I visited England on a similar mission and spoke in some 10 cities, some of them blitzed and badly done up, with the nights made darker by a universal blackout. In those days, too, I carried away with me memories of a very warm and welcome and response, and of a very generous, courageous, and loyal English Jewry. In Israel, we arrived at the loveliest time of the year, between Purim and Pesach, when, to quote the Song of Songs, the flowers appear on the earth and the time of singing is come. And what a relief that was, after the long months here in Cleveland, months of ice and snow. Evidently, many other people were attracted to the warmth and sunshine of that beautiful land. The country was full of tourists. Israel was expecting this year some 225,000 tourists. Last year, it had 183,000. And in 1966, they tell me that they would be expecting 370,000 tourists. Tourism has become a major industry in Israel. And hotels are being rapidly built to accommodate the large influx. And some of these hotels, as sumptuous as any you will find in Miami, and just as expensive. Israel, in fact, is becoming a tourist paradise. Incomparable scenic beauty, 4,000 years of history, the holy land of Jew and Christian, the drama and excitement of a pioneering nation forging a new life. All this is proving to be an irresistible magnet for an increasing number of tourists and pilgrims. I have visited Israel many times. I visited when it was still Palestine. And yet every time I visit the country, I find something new that I had not seen before. We visited this year the excavations which are being carried on at Caesarea. As impressive excavations as any on the historic Mediterranean shores. Caesarea was at one time a city of 250,000 inhabitants. It was founded in the first century of the Common Era by Herod the Great in honor of Emperor Augustus Caesar, hence its name, Caesarea. It became an important port and was the seat of Roman procurators and the headquarters of Roman legions. It was a large city in which Roman, Greek, and Jew lived side by side. Caesarea in the 7th century of the Common Era was conquered by the Arabs, and in the 11th century by the Crusaders. And then it was laid waste, completely waste, by the Sultans who expelled the Crusaders from Palestine. And since that time, and for over 600 years, that city, once inhabited by 250,000 people, was nothing more than a heap, ruins buried under mountains of sand. And what was not buried by the sand was a vast malarial swamp. Well, Caesarea is today being excavated, and remarkable finds have already been brought to light. The remains of synagogues, of pagan temples, of churches, many mosaics, many statues. One of them had the inscription Pontius Pilate on it. Ancient medieval fortifications and a complete Roman amphitheater with a stage and tiers upon tiers of stone seats were unearthed. And 2 years ago, as part of an international music festival which was held in Israel, the world famous Pablo Casal, then 85 years old, gave an open air concert, a cello recital, in this very amphitheater. The similar excavations were being carried out in other parts of the country. We visited another in the city of Beth She'an, a city 5,000 years old, in the valley of Jezreel, not far from the Jordan. Ancient Canaanite and Egyptian and Greek and Roman and many others had in turn conquered and ruled that strategic city. And you may recall from your Bible that it was in the plain before that city, at the foot of Mount Gilboa, that King Saul and his son Jonathan were slain in their last battle with the Philistines. And it was on the walls of Beth She'an that their bodies were hung and exposed. When we were there, Israeli archaeologists were completing the excavation of another magnificent Roman amphitheater. In this area where excavation had been carried on for 40 years. We visited for the first time the remarkable catacombs in Beth She'arim, not far from Haifa. Professor Mazur, who lectured here in the temple a few weeks ago, is responsible for the discovery and excavations of these amazing catacombs. Beth She'arim was a noted city in the early centuries of the Common Era, in the time of the Mishnah. It was the seat of the Sanhedrin, and the compiler of the Mishnah, Judah Hanasi, is buried in these catacombs. And these catacombs, with their hundreds of underground rooms and corridors, and sarcophagi of every description, tell so much of the civilization, the art, the wealth, the social customs of those early centuries. I mention these facts because the land of Israel is a veritable treasure house of antiquities, and here the past, as well as the exciting and teeming present, has much to offer and to intrigue the tourist. I found Israel prosperous, growing, expanding. Everywhere you turn, you see buildings, new buildings springing up, apartments, private dwellings, and public buildings, and schools, and hospitals, and shops, and factories. In fact, one begins to hear now in Israel voices raised cautioning people against excessive investment in building. The population of the country is increasing, not only as a result of the natural normal birth increase, but through immigration. Last year, some 70,000 new immigrants came into the country from many parts of the world, especially from North Africa. There is no unemployment in Israel. In fact, there's an actual shortage of labor. New cities have been established, especially in the Negev, in the south. And old cities have been expanded. The very old cities, for example, of Tiberias and Nazareth have built on the hills overlooking them large and modern suburbs where thousands of people live in comfortable homes and apartments. They have their schools, their synagogues, their parks, their cinemas, their community centers, and their supermarkets. Jerusalem, the city which, because of its history and location, is one of the most attractive cities in the world. In my mind, the most attractive capital in the world. Jerusalem is adding to its physical beauty many new and inspiring and imposing edifices. A new art museum, which will take its place among the fine art museums of the world, is in the process of completion. The new parliament building, which the Rothschilds have given as a gift to the State of Israel. The Yad Vashem, the impressive memorial which has been erected to the millions of the Nazi victims. The expanding and beautiful campus of the Hebrew University. The imposing Hadassah Hospital, and the medical school, and the new school for Bible study and archaeology, which was erected by the Hebrew Union College, whose dedication we were privileged to attend, as well as Mr. and Mrs. Leo Newmark of our temple. These buildings and many, many more are adding to the beauty of this city, this ancient, this modern city. And what impressed me most is the tempo of the country's progress, the speed of construction, the elan, the dynamo. What today is a dream, a prospect, a prospectus, is tomorrow a startling reality. We visited Ashdod. Ashdod was one of the ancient Philistine cities. Until recently, it was little more than a stretch of sand dunes along the Mediterranean, some 40 miles south of Tel Aviv. They decided to build a new port there to serve as the outlet for the agricultural and industrial products of the central part and the southern part of Israel. And they obtained a loan of $52 million from the World Bank. And they proceeded to build the port. We were there 2 years ago. And all that we saw at Ashdod was a few houses, a central office building, where quite a number of engineers and architects were working on blueprints. And that was all that we saw 2 years ago. When we returned now, 2 years later, half of the port had been completed. 12,000 people were living in Ashdod in homes and apartments. A school had been erected. A cinema, a supermarket, a lovely park with fountains had been laid out. And a power station was in operation, supplying electricity to this port city and to the outlying regions. And they assured me in Ashdod that in a few years, Ashdod will have a population of 400,000. And I believe them. On the occasion of my visit to Ashdod, they made me the first honorary citizen of that city. Now, an honorary citizen is one who has all the privileges of citizenship, but does not have to pay taxes. And I'm sure that Sir Winston Churchill must have taken this fact into consideration when he accepted the citizenship, honorary citizenship of the United States. Industrially, the country is making rapid progress. The emphasis today is upon industry rather than upon agriculture, for the agricultural development is nearing a saturation point. New industries have been established. The exports of the country have increased. Israel is now negotiating for a trade agreement with the European Common Market so that it will be able to export its products to the European market on favorable terms. Israel had a break this year in that a new oil well was brought in near Ashkelon, the most important oil discovery to date, which may make the country self-sufficient in fuel requirements. I'm interested to know that over £100 million have been invested so far in oil prospecting in Israel. experiments in the desalination of water, that is, in sweetening up salt water to supply water cheaply to the country, are being energetically carried on. And I was interested to read that south of Haifa, a 250-acre solar energy pool will be completed this year, which will absorb and concentrate the energy produced by the sun. Now, there are problems, of course, aplenty in Israel. Social problems, educational, religious, international. I will speak of one or two of these in a moment. I do not wish to give you the impression that everything in Israel is in apple pie order. The good Lord has never been that good to our people. He never spoiled his people by overindulging them in ease or in tranquility. But what delighted me was the spirit of the land, which was almost palpable. The enterprise, the courage, the pride, the hopefulness. One day we climbed a rugged mountain in Lower Galilee. And after a long and hard climb, we reached the top of the mountain in a jeep, where a group of 23 Sabras, native-born young Israeli men and women, were building a new kibbutz. Their quarters were primitive, their equipment rudimentary, their food of the simplest, but they were there to establish a new settlement in one of the wild parts of the Galil. "Why did you choose this particular spot?" I asked one of the young men. He pointed to a hill not far from where we stood. "That is Yutpat," he said. And I recalled my history. Yutpat was the last stronghold in Galilee where the Jewish forces, under their commander Josephus, better known to us as a famous historian, but he was the commander of the Jewish forces in the Galilee during the revolt against Rome, where the Jewish forces held out against the Romans who besieged them. And when they could no longer hold out, rather than surrender, they killed each other. And he said, this young man, "They killed each other, you see, in that very cave, on that hill." And so within sight of that cave, these Sabras, 1900 years later, resolved to build a new settlement, a new Judean stronghold. It's that spirit, undefeated, proud, resolute, what delighted me. It gave me great confidence. Sometimes that spirit manifested itself in strange ways. On our way to this mountaintop in Lower Galilee, we stopped to change over from the automobile to the jeep, because the automobile could not manipulate the second half of the mountain. And as we were standing there, a young man came across the fields towards us. And as he approached me, he said, "Hello, Rabbi Silver." I said, "Hello, who are you?" He said, "I'm so-and-so from Chicago." I said, what are you doing here? He said, I'm building a dude ranch. I was tempted to say, are you Miss Sugar? But I didn't. He said, yes, I'm building here a dude ranch. I already have 10 fine Arab horses. I'm building a swimming pool and I've begun to build ranch houses. This will be a beautiful spot for people to come who love duding. He said, I haven't got all the money yet, but I'm raising roses, 100 variety of roses, which I'm exporting from the profits. I expect to complete this project. Now, he says, the roses aren't yet in bloom. But, he said, if you just wait a moment, and he rushed back to wherever his headquarters were, and he came back, and he presented Mrs. Silver with a bouquet of green onions, chives, and radishes from his own truck garden. He wanted her to remember him. He came across some very exciting things in Israel, but for initiative and private enterprise, this was among the most startling things I saw in Israel. The day before we left the country, I read in the Israeli press where a group of young Israeli celebrated a torchlight Seder on top of the ancient fortress of Masada on the shores of the Dead Sea. Those who know the heroic story of Masada will appreciate the dramatic symbolism of this torchlight Seder on the top of that mountain, the last stronghold of the desperately resisting forces of Israel in the war against Rome. And that Seder linked the generations of undefeated and free-born men across the chasm of the centuries. There are problems in present-day Israel. The presence of hundreds of thousands of Arab refugees on the borders of the country, and the matter of national security continue to be the major problems which engross the attention of the government and to a lesser degree of the people. The people of Israel are continuously aware of the problems, but they are in no way alarmed by them, nor are they deflected from whatever task they are engaged in. They know the facts of life under which they are building their homeland. They are surrounded by unreconciled and numerically superior neighbors whose leaders are repeatedly avowing their intention to exterminate them. And some of these neighbors, especially Egypt, have been receiving heavy military equipment and the most modern weapons, as well as technical advice and training from the Soviet Union, just as Cuba has been receiving them from the same source. And the generous financial aid which Egypt has been receiving from the United States for non-military purposes, of course, to help the people of Egypt whose standards of living is among the lowest in the Middle East. Even that aid has helped Nasser to divert much of his country's revenues to military purposes. Egypt has been employing German scientists, erstwhile Nazis, to build for it jet fighters and to develop ground-to-ground rocket missiles, which are intended, of course, to be used against Israel. While we were abroad, an Israeli security agent was arrested in Switzerland on the charge of threatening the daughter of a German scientist by name of Gerke, who has been working in Egypt on nuclear weapons. And the Israeli Knesset was, of course, aroused, and it met in special session and adopted a unanimous resolution, which it said that the Knesset resolves that the activity of German scientists and experts working in Egypt and the manufacture of weapons of mass destruction to be used against Israel is a grave danger to the security of Israel and its population. The German people cannot absolve itself of the responsibility for the continuation of this vile work. It is the duty of the German government to put an immediate end to this dangerous activity of its citizens and to take all steps required to prevent this cooperation with the Egyptian government. Now, no formal action on the part of the German government has as yet been taken in this matter, though sympathy with the Israeli position has been expressed in government circles. This has disturbed the people of Israel. An attempt was made recently to unite the Arab world. Previous attempts had failed. The Arab League, which was formed in 1945, failed in its efforts to achieve common action among the Arab states due to national, personal, and group rivalries. The United Arab Republic, which Nasser established in 1958 by uniting Egypt and Syria, fell apart. It lasted just a little over 3 years. But now a new political union, a tri-state federation, has been formed, composed of Egypt and Syria and Iraq. How long this federation will last, no one can foretell. The inner rivalries and party strife have, of course, not been eliminated from among the several Arab states. Will this new federation inaugurate an era of stability in the Middle East or an era of aggression and military adventure? That is, again, very difficult to say in advance. It is generally acknowledged that the Arab states, separately or jointly, at this moment, are not able, economically or militarily, to undertake a military campaign against Israel, unless they are materially aided by a foreign power. An attack upon Israel is not likely to remain an isolated event or one which can be regionally contained. It may lead to a global conflict which neither East nor West desires or is likely to permit. And the Arab governments also know that Israel is not defenseless or without friends, but it can give as much as it can take, and that the distance for missiles and jet fighters and bombers to travel is exactly the same from Tel Aviv to Cairo, Damascus, or Baghdad, as from Cairo, Damascus, and Baghdad to Tel Aviv. But the danger is there, and the situation at the moment has grave potentialities. And in the sober knowledge of all this, the people of Israel are going about the business of building their homeland with singleness of purpose and unafraid. Though hoping for support from the free world, they are relying primarily upon themselves and their own defenses. Recently, Major General Moshe Dayan, who you will recall took the Sinai Peninsula away from the Egyptians in 56 and led the Israeli forces to the very banks of the Suez Canal. Recently, Dayan stated, "In this era of rockets with conventional and unconventional warheads, President Nasser would be deterred from starting a war primarily by the might of Israel's defense forces. We must therefore diligently develop our weapons that we do not lag." The Israeli, my dear friends, are reconciled to a long Arab-Israel stalemate. The Arab states are evidently not interested in solving the refugee problem, except on the condition of the liquidation of the State of Israel. And the Israelis know this, and they are reacting accordingly. Their expenditures for national security constitute a terrific drain upon their limited national income. But they know that for the time being it cannot be helped, and they are paying heavy taxes to ensure their security. Now, of course, things may change. And on the international political checkerboard, they often do change, and in the most unexpected ways. But in the meantime, the people of Israel cannot and will not permit themselves to live in a fool's paradise. Watching this desperate game which Nasser is playing, our own government seems to be undisturbed. Our State Department is satisfied that a balance of power exists in the Middle East and that therefore the security of Israel is not endangered. One finds it difficult to follow the reasoning of Under Secretary of State W. Averill Harriman, who does not at all seem to be critical of the work which the German missile scientists are doing in Egypt. For, he says, if it were not German scientists who were doing it, Soviet scientists would be there to do the same work. We wonder whether this is all the wisdom and statesmanship which our State Department can bring to bear upon this perilous situation which is developing in the Near East. One would like to hear a clear-cut statement on the part of our government regarding its deep concern for the continued security of Israel. One would like to hear a word of rebuke to the Arab governments who are so shamelessly threatening to destroy a peaceful and sovereign state which the American government has recognized and which, in point of fact, it helped to bring into existence. I found the people of Israel deeply concerned and troubled by this cool, formal, standoffish attitude of our State Department in a situation which calls for action and leadership. Well, my dear friends, we left Israel during the week of Passover after we celebrated two Seders in Nahariya, in a rest home for the disabled war veterans, which was built there, a very beautiful rest home, by an American philanthropist. We left Israel during the week of Passover, the festival which celebrates Israel's birth as a nation some 3,300 years ago, and we arrived in Rome by plane 3 hours later. Rome, the center of the Christian world, was preparing to celebrate Easter, the festival which commemorates the resurrection of Christendom's Messiah, of Jesus the Jew, who lived in Palestine some 2,000 years ago. We spent a few days in Rome. We visited again the Forum and its stately ruins, and we stood again before the imposing Arch of Titus, the arch which was erected to celebrate the triumph of Titus over the Judean state in 70 of the Common Era. And we saw the bas-relief under the arcade of that arch, which shows the procession of Jewish captive slaves carrying the spoils of the temple, which Titus had destroyed, the golden table, the seven-branched menorah, and the silver trumpets. And all about us were ruins, all that was left of the grandeur of ancient imperial Rome, the proud conquerors of ancient Judea. But I had just come from that ultimately unconquered land of Judea. And with my own eyes, I had seen the ultimately undefeated children of Judea planting the seeds of a new life amidst the ancient ruins. I had seen the legions of Jewish Chalutzim rebuilding what the legions of ancient Rome and those of subsequent empires had destroyed. And the sounds of the Easter bells were ringing throughout the city. And as they reached my ears, they told me that it was not Rome that conquered Judea, but a humble Jew from Judea who conquered Rome. And what a strange and baffling people these Jews were, conquered time and again, but outliving all their conquerors. I thought of many things that Easter week in Rome. I thought of the theme of resurrection, which is the theme of the Easter festival. But I thought of Israel, the risen people of the immemorial crucifixion. I thought of the resurrection of an ancient land, the ancient land of Israel, which was so long consigned death and desolation. And I reflected upon the death of all the Caesars and the crumbling into dust of the empires which they built. And then I thought also of immortality, of the deathlessness of truth and faith and the spirit of man, and the word of God which endures forever. And so in Rome, I thought again of Jerusalem, Yerushalayim HaBenuya, Jerusalem which I saw rising from its very ruins, and of the mountains which surrounded it, even as the Lord that surrounded and sheltered his people throughout the grim and dolorous centuries. And so, my dear friends, my few days in Rome, just before we took plane for home, my few days in Rome proved to be a heartening supplement and commentary and epilogue to all that I had seen and experienced in the old, new land of Israel.